team for leading this township today. I have the great privilege of working with a seminary here in Thailand, and 2 weeks ago, we had a graduation ceremony in Bangkok. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not really one for ceremony myself. I never understood why we have to dress up in these funny robes and parade around like penguins. But that is, in fact, what we do. And as we went through the ceremony, we're up on the stage and we're looking out at the graduates and the audience. And my boss, the president of the university, looked over to me and said, "Enjoy this day. This is the fruit of your labor." Now, I know he meant that as an encouragement, but that made me really scared. First thing I was thinking is, how well did we train this group of graduates? But then the second thing I was thinking is, we had 24 graduates that we're sending out into the world of spiritual leadership. Any of you in that world, spiritual leadership, religious leaders? That's a scary world to be in, isn't it? There's a lot of responsibility in that world. And I'm just thinking to myself, wow, here I am sending them out, are they ready? Some people have joked that ministry would be easy if it weren't for people. And I think that's probably true, but maybe something that we don't emphasize as much is that the leaders are one of those people. A leader has to always struggle with their own sins, their own faults and temptations, and repeated failures, which makes leadership even harder than it is. And think of the great responsibility of leading people into relationship with God. Who would want to raise their hand and say, "Yeah, that's me. I want to be a leader"? And it's no wonder that James tells us that teachers will be judged more strictly. I think that's probably true of leaders in general. Well, we've been going through the book of Mark, and we're now at chapter 12, where Jesus has some words to say about spiritual leadership. In fact, some pretty harsh words about the dangers of leadership. And that's what we're going to look at today, the parable of the tenants. And as you're turning there, let me give you a little bit of background on what's going on here. This is the Passion Week for Jesus. He's now entered Jerusalem. This is his last week on earth. And if you're familiar with the book of Mark, he spends 6 chapters on 1 week of Jesus' life and 10 chapters on the rest of his life. So this is a pretty key week for the life of Jesus, and of course Mark is emphasizing that. The week started out with a bang. Jesus enters into the city on a colt. People are waving their palm branches, proclaiming and welcoming their king. And it sounds like things are going to go pretty well when Jesus gets into Jerusalem. But we get a hint that everything's going to change when Jesus curses the fig tree. And we know something's going to happen. Judgment is coming. The focus of chapters 11 through 13 is on the temple. Jesus enters Jerusalem, and his focus here is on the temple. And the first thing he does when he walks into the temple is he throws over the money tables, drives out the money changers, and causes a ruckus. This is not the Jesus meek and mild. This is the Jesus stirring the pot. And the religious leaders are getting pretty frustrated. Well, the next day, Jesus comes back into town, and again, he heads straight for the temple. And you can just imagine that when he enters the temple, of course, the primary spot in all of Israel, where all the focus, religious focus is, Jesus enters, and the crowds start gathering around him. And you can just imagine that what they're thinking is, what is this guy going to do next, right? And the religious leaders are in a bit of a pickle here. They don't know what to do because they've got this guy who's causing all of this, these problems, and the crowds are starting to follow him. They know they must confront him. And the only way to confront him is to get the crowd to turn. And this is a very common practice in the first century, that if you really want to win, you have to win a game in public. You challenge somebody to a duel. And it's a duel of words. An argument that will take place between the religious leaders and Jesus. And the goal of this game is to embarrass your opponent. The more embarrassed your opponent is, the more you win. Right? So Jesus and the religious leaders are facing each other. The crowds are gathered. And they're all waiting for the game to begin. And the religious leaders start the game. And they start with a question. Jesus, who gave you the authority to come in here and do these things? Of course, referring to the turning over of the tables and driving out the money changers. And Jesus is pretty good at this game, actually. And he doesn't answer them. the Baptist, his baptism, was it from heaven or from men? Oh man, that's a bold move. Jesus knows exactly what he's doing, because if you think of the crowds around here, they still revere John the Baptist as a prophet. The religious leaders know this, okay? So we have this kind of insight in Mark into what the leaders are talking about amongst themselves. And they're basically arguing, how do we answer this question? Because if we say it's from heaven, he's going to say, well, why did you follow him? But if we say it was from men, all the crowds will get upset and Jesus will win. What do we do? This is quite a quandary for them. And so all of these great minds of Israel come together and come up with an answer. We don't know. Which is, of course, the answer of every theologian in seminaries. We don't know. And now that they didn't really have any other choice. I mean, what else do you say in that kind of situation? Well, based on that statement, Jesus says, well, neither am I going to tell you my authority. Jesus won, leaders zero. They were trying to shame Jesus, but instead they're the ones who were shamed. But Jesus doesn't stop there. He's going for the knockout punch. And he's going to win this argument and make the leaders look pretty foolish in front of all these crowds. And if you're thinking of the book of Mark, the chapter division here is horribly placed, because this parable of the tenants is the knockout punch to this argument. So you're imagining you're in the temple, the leaders of Jesus are facing each other, the crowds are watching. Jesus has just won the first round, and then he tells this parable. Chapter 12, verse 1. He then began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the winepress, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. Now the power of a parable is that it connects everyday life to spiritual truth. Now for many of us, as we hear this parable, it doesn't really connect to our everyday lives. I don't know how many of you own vineyards or rent it out to tenants. Anybody? Of course, here in Thailand, I think there is some renting out of farmyards. But the idea here is people would understand this immediately. They know this situation. It's a very common practice in the first century where an owner has a plot of land, and rather than growing their own vineyards, they hire somebody to come in and do the growing and then bring the produce. The owner lives somewhere else. And in the contract, it stipulates that at the end of the harvest time, the owner has a right to a portion of the produce. Now, if this is a vineyard, the produce is wine, okay? So that's kind of how it functions. And as Jesus starts this parable, everybody's going, okay, yeah, I get that. He starts it in a very interesting way, though. Notice how many details he gives to this parable. That they put a wall around it, dug a pit for the wine press, built a watchtower. This is a lot of detail for a parable, more so than usual. Because what Jesus is actually doing here is he's quoting exactly the words from Isaiah chapter 5. And in Isaiah 5, there's another story about another vineyard that's producing bad grapes. And that story starts the exact same way. I think what Jesus is doing here is he's priming his audience. You know, you got the religious leaders, you got the crowds. These people know Isaiah pretty well. And by starting in this way, it's automatically getting them to think in terms of prophecy and judgment. And that's exactly what this parable is about. Now, a spoiler alert. The tenants are the religious leaders, okay? So they knew this at the end. If you go down to the end of the chapter, they know it's about them. But I think it's good for us to keep that in mind, and I don't think it's a surprise to you, but we should say it right up front. Verse 2. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. He sent still another, and that one they killed. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. All right, so now it's time to receive his payment. And the landowner, the landlord, sends a servant, because perhaps he's thirsty. He's ready to get a portion of the produce. He sends one servant. That servant is beaten and comes back empty-handed. Sends another servant. That servant is beaten on the head, sent back empty-handed. He sends another servant. That servant is killed and never comes back. He keeps sending these servants over and over. In fact, we have no idea how many servants he says, because in verse 5 he says he keeps on sending them. Even though they're getting beaten and bruised, there's an escalation of violence taking place in this parable. What Jesus is doing here is he's really summarizing the whole Old Testament, isn't he? The Old Testament is a story of Israel's repeated failure, but God's unending patience. Israel was supposed to be a model of community, weren't they? God gave them the law, and he says, you're going to be a kingdom of priests. So be a model to the nations around you so that they, when they see you and see the law you have, they say, wow, what a great God you have. And they want to come to you. They should be attracted to you. What kind of model community was Israel? Well, they were a model of injustice, a model of idol worship, a model of complaining, a model of general faithlessness. And the leaders were probably the worst of the bunch. Think of Elijah on Mount Carmel battling the priests of Baal, right? The sole priest of Yahweh battling all the priests of Baal, and as he escapes Jezebel trying to kill him, he goes to Mount Horeb. You remember that story? And he's there at Mount Horeb, and he's going to confront God, and God's going to talk to him. And Elijah says this. He says, I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of Israel. For the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They throw down your altars. They killed your prophets with the sword. And now I only am the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me. Now God assures him there are others out there. You're not the last one. But the point here is this is a commentary on the state of the nation of Israel. It's gotten so bad that he thinks he's the only servant of the Lord left. They've killed prophet after prophet. They've beaten them, hit them on the head, killed them. And now Elijah's in fear of his own life. Jesus, as he's saying this, and it's bringing to mind the whole history of Israel, think of who he's talking to here. The religious leaders of the temple. They were back there in Elijah's day. They were in the Old Testament. But what he's saying is they're carrying on a long tradition of the abuse of power, of the exploitation of the poor, of the perversion of justice, and the general misleading of the people. They've rejected the prophets along the way. Most notably, most recently, they rejected John the Baptist. Now let's just pause there, because as you think about this part of the parable, put yourself in the owner's place. Okay? You're the landlord, and you have this field where all your tenants are serving and making the produce, and now it's time to go get your portion. It's your right, right? And you send a servant, and your servant comes back all bloody, with their head bruised, and with no produce. So you say, okay, well, I'm going to send another servant. And that servant doesn't come back. He's dead. Now stop right there. What are you thinking right now? What's your plan? Now, if it were me, I would be thinking, man, let's go get the police. Let's go get some authorities, maybe my own personal gang. We're going to go down there and take care of business. We're going to go teach these guys a lesson. But what does the landlord do? He sends servant after servant after servant, thinking, I'm going to give them one more chance. Oh, you know what? Let's give them another chance. How about another chance? And you're thinking, this guy's got to be crazy. Aren't you glad you're not one of those servants? If you're last in the line, you're like, no, I don't think so. I don't really want to go on this one. But he keeps on sending them. The point, of course, is think of the faithfulness, the patience of God in the Old Testament. How many prophets did he send? Prophet after prophet, patience after patience, saying, I'm going to give them another chance to repent. Okay, they didn't do that. One more time. All right, they didn't do it that time. All right, let's try it again. How many times can you possibly give somebody another chance? That's the patience of our God. And aren't you thankful for that? You know, it's not an attribute of God we talk very much about. We usually talk more about his love, his grace, his mercy. But patience is a key and necessary attribute of God for our salvation. Paul says in 1 Timothy, he was a blasphemer, a persecutor, an insolent opponent, but I received mercy for this reason, and in me, as the foremost sinner, I don't know if I consider myself a blasphemer. But when I look at the history of my life, it's failure after failure after failure. My victories are very short-lived. I don't know if that's just me or if this is kind of a general thing about humans. But that's my experience. And when it finally gets to that point where I realize how patient God is with me and I thank Him for it, the very next moment I get impatient with the person next to me who just failed. How does God put up with me? See, our God isn't just patience. He is patience. And thankfully, because of that patience, we can be saved. The story continues in verse 6, because he's got somebody else to send. He says he had one left to send, a son, whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, they will respect my son. But the tenants said to one another, this is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. Well, the situation has got pretty serious for the landlord. He's got a mutiny on his hands. He's lost all his servants, or the ones that he still has left are so beaten and bruised they can't do anything else. And he says to himself, I've got one more. I'm going to send my only son. Well, that's a pretty bold, risky move, isn't it? I mean, look at how they treated the servants. But we got insight into the mind of the landlord because he says, they'll certainly respect my son. Who in their right mind would beat or kill the son of the owner? Of course they wouldn't do that. So he takes this bold move and sends his son. Now, this is a bit of a surprise in this story because generally at this point you would think the owner himself would go. But instead he sends the son. And as the son is walking toward the vineyard and the tenants are looking and say, oh, isn't that the son? Why is the son coming? And in their mind, all of a sudden, the wheels are turning. And they're realizing that the son must be coming because the landlord is dead. The son is coming to claim his inheritance. They mistakenly make the assumption that if the landlord is dead and we kill the son, the inheritance is ours because we're the occupants of the land. And so as the son comes into the vineyard, they kill him. They throw him over the wall without a proper burial. And they think now they own the vineyard. Well, it's quite a plot, and this parable is called the judgment parable because with every parable, there's always a main point that comes at the end. And this one is where Jesus asks a question that is so obvious that everybody would know the answer, right? So you think of all the crowds, the religious leaders there, all hearing this parable. They all know about the practice of tenant farming. And as Jesus comes to the end, he asks this question. Verse 9, what then will the owner of the vineyard do? Well, that's a pretty easy answer, isn't it? In fact, in Matthew, the crowd or the religious leaders give the answer. Here, Jesus answers it himself. He says, he will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. So the answer here is we got to change the tenants. It's time for new tenants. The landlord is not dead. In fact, when the landlord finds out that his son has been killed, he's going to come with his posse and take care of business once and for all. Get rid of the tenants and replace them with new ones. Obviously, the point of this parable is quite obvious in the life of Christ and who he's talking to, right? Jesus is the Son. The tenants are the religious leaders. They have rejected the Messiah, and now God's purposes lie no longer with the religious leaders and the Jewish system, but is now going to the church. I don't know about you, but I feel a lot of sympathy for the religious leaders. We often picture them as bad guys. Maybe, in our imaginations, we picture them as kind of a group of no good hoodlums, wearing black leather jackets and Satan tattoos on their arms, and they're always up to no good, right? These religious leaders and Pharisees and chief priests, they always have that negative connotation. But of course, these are the religious leaders, right? Kind of like what many of us are. These are the good guys in the view of the Israelites. And as we come through the story, I actually relate a lot with them. I understand their position. Let me imagine that you're a chief priest, and your responsibility is in the primary temple of all of Israel, You have a great responsibility on your hands. And in comes this revolutionary. And of course, in the first century, there's a lot of revolutionaries. Jesus wasn't the only one. And he comes into the temple, and he starts turning over the tables, driving out the money changers, and preaching something that's totally the opposite of what the sermon he preached the week before. How would that make you feel? You know, imagine somebody coming in here right now and flipping over the candle and all the musical instruments. The natural thing that we would want to say is, what authority do you have to do that? Right? That's exactly the question the leaders asked Jesus. What authority do you have to do that? Or, you know what, I really get the money system in the temple. As we found out last week, you know, everybody's living out in all of these parts of Israel, and you have to come in to bring your sacrifices. Well, you can't bring in all your goats and lambs and doves and whatever you need. It just makes sense to buy them there at the temple. That's just convenience, isn't it? And if you're going to have it at the temple, think of, you know, just charge a little bit more how much money you can make to support the system of the temple. Can you imagine what kind of budget the temple had? It must have been significant. And so if you sell it, the animals right there on the premise, make a little bit of profit, you can sustainably support your ministry. I leave the seminary where I'm at, and I think this way all the time. How can I creatively think of new ways to support the ministry? That's called sustainability, right? Seems like that's the mind of the religious leaders. Well, let's take it a step further. The religious leaders could easily say, hey, look around us. Pagans are ruling our nation. Our way of life is threatened. God gave us the law. He gave us the temple. He gave us the sacrificial system. And as priests, we have a responsibility to maintain the system. That's why we're here. And if we don't, think of what could happen to Yahweh worship. How many of you are on the side of the leaders now? It just makes sense. Where did they go wrong? I would suggest that what they didn't go wrong because they weren't doing what they were supposed to do. I actually think they were doing what they were supposed to do. They were doing the temple practices. They were studying the Torah. Right? They were leading the sacrifices. They're doing the stuff they're supposed to do. The problem was they did all the right things for the wrong reasons. They lost sight of the big picture. I enjoy mountain biking quite a bit. And I go every week. And about 2 months ago, I was out on a trip coming down to North Utah, the Lake Mountain, right by the airport. And this was probably a bit of an extreme trail for me. I'm not that great. And this one had jumps and roots and all kinds of stuff, and it was downhill, so I was going really cautiously. And as I'm coming down the mountain, you know, I'm kind of nervous, and I'm coming down the steep parts, and I'm focused entirely on what's right in front of me. Because you have so many rocks and roots, that if you're not watching where you're going, you're going to fall very easily, right? So I'm coming down, looking and seeing, you know, maneuvering around all this stuff. The problem is, I wasn't looking at what's coming. And what was coming was a route with a drop-off on the other side of the route that was this deep. Now, I'm not that great of a mountain biker. I don't do the jump off that like some might. I go around it. But it came up so quickly, and I wasn't looking for it, that by the time I saw it, I didn't have time to stop. I mean, the hill's like this. So I'm hitting the brakes, and I realized I'm not going around it. I'm not jumping it. I've got to go over it. And my bike came over, my front tire hit like this, almost at a 90-degree angle, and I flipped over, hit my head straight on the ground, pretty hard, thankfully I had a helmet on, bruised my rib, and hurt my leg, which I can still feel even today, 2 months later. In fact, after I was done, I was sitting there, my friend was with me, and I started getting blurred vision, thinking, oh no, I got a concussion. Thankfully it went away, and I'm fine, I think. But that was a scary point. Now, after I did that, very foolish thing, I realized how stupid I was. Because one of the first rules of mountain biking is you can't just look down to where you're going right at the moment. You always have to look ahead. You have to keep going back and forth. And it makes sense, right? I mean, you have to maneuver the roots and the rocks, but if you're not seeing what's coming, you're going to do what I did. And so I was pretty upset with myself. That's exactly what the religious leaders are doing. They are so focused on what's in front of them, but they're not do you get hundreds of people to go and kill thousands, break pillage, you know, take over Jerusalem? Is the Pope would use the phrase, Deus vult, God wills it. That was the war cry of the First Crusade. God wills it. What a way to take spiritual authority and twist it to a new end. Or think of the indulgences at the time of Martin Luther. You know, how are you going to fund this brand new awesome basilica in the city of Rome? Well, you sell an indulgence and say, if you just give me a few coins, you don't have to go to hell. What a way to manipulate people with spiritual authority. Well, you say, well, that's kind of historical, right? In the past 10 to 20 years, how many cases of sexual abuse have happened within the church? Church organizations, mission organizations, denominations, and they're dealing with one right now in the U.S. Over and over and over. How often do we take spiritual authority and twist it for our own selfish ends? Of course, those are extreme cases, but I actually think this is probably what we all do all the time. Maybe on a smaller scale. How many of us look for success in ministry, not necessarily to further God's kingdom, but because we like the recognition? How many of us strive for leadership, not to serve, but because we like the prestige? How many of us give money to the needy, not really to help them, but because it makes us feel good about ourselves? How many of us come to church to really worship and commune with one another instead of just trying to get that next spiritual high and get us through the week? How easy it is for us to do all the right things for all the wrong reasons. We're so focused looking down without seeing the big picture of what's happening. I must say that when I was preparing for this, I'm thinking to myself, I mean, how many of us are chief priests and Pharisees? You know, how can we really relate this? And the more I got into it, the more I realized how this is the story of sinful humanity right here. How deep our sinful heart goes, of how we can take even the best things that God has given us and twist them to lift ourselves up. I get disheartened by that. And I look at my own heart and I'm thinking, what in the world am I doing up here preaching? It's so easy to despair. And I think you've got to get to that point of despair because there are two more verses that's going to take us out of despair and come back to this parable for a moment. Verse 10. Haven't you read the scripture, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone? The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. That stone that the builders rejected, the religious leaders rejected, Jesus Christ, the one they rejected because they were so short-sighted, because they're so busy grasping for power and authority, that same stone that was rejected, God took that and made it into the cornerstone. And it's marvelous in our eyes. While we tend to take good things and twist them toward evil ends, you know what God's tendency is? To take our evil things and take them, turn them into good. When we are at our worst, God, by his patience and grace, does his best. So in this parable, this is what brought me out of despair. Because in this parable is the gospel itself. The parable, yes, it's a judgment on religious leaders. It's also a judgment on us. But at the end of it, we have the lifting up of the cornerstone. Jesus Christ, through his death and resurrection, gives us hope, brings us out.